Daniel Webster had a problem, a big one, and as he rode to the Senate podium to make his speech, it weighed heavy on his mind. The date was March 7, 1850, and the speech would define Webster's political career. Webster had always been a committed opponent of slavery. From 1814 to the time of the speech, he had, with a small interruption, served Massachusetts in the House or the Senate as a Whig and an anti-slavery Whig at that. Now, along with the Lion of Congress, Henry Clay, a man who had also served in both the House and the Senate over about the same period, he was supporting a compromise, one that would do a lot of good things. Things that would never get done in a Congress with Southern members who could block legislation. Members, even Southern members, were about to abolish the trading of slaves in the nation's capital, a practice which was embarrassing for many in the North and troublesome for foreign visitors to the capital, many of whom had abolished slavery in their countries long ago. In addition to that, the state of California, the far-off land that represented the future of America, was about to enter the Union as a free state. These were big steps. Nevada, Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, territories that had been won during the recent war with Mexico, would be admitted to the Union with no mention of their status. The territorial governments that would form there could decide. And if, like in California, miners and working men who didn't want to compete with unpaid labor, voted for those states to be free, they would be free as well. This was an incredible batch of legislation for abolitionists, for those who wanted to contain slavery. Except for one problem. The price of getting some of the pro-slavery Whig votes was that in addition to all of this legislation, a fugitive slave law would be passed requiring the federal government to return slaves who were owned by Southerners who had escaped to the northern states would have to be returned. A slave who went as far as Maine would have to be brought back to Georgia. This was despicable for northern abolitionists. For friends of abolitionism, the support of Daniel Webster for such an abhorrent crime was compared to the fall of an archangel. Worse, they called him a bankrupt politician seeking the presidency. For his part, Webster would emphasize that the Constitution already required the return of slaves and that all members of Congress had swore an oath to abide by the Constitution. And right now, it wasn't being enforced. And all the legislation did was provide for that enforcement that had already been agreed upon. The benefits, Webster argued, for fulfilling constitutional duty was the new free states, the ban on slavery trading in D.C., the possible containment of slavery in the South, and, most importantly, the preservation of the Union. I speak not as a man of Massachusetts, not as a Whig, Webster said, but as an American. Webster was derided, as was Henry Clay, pro-slavery and abolitionists, men who were far apart as could be on American politics of the day, men like William Seward, the newly elected Whig from New York, an abolitionist, and Jefferson Davis, the stalwart of Mississippi, both agreed on one thing. They didn't like what Webster and Clay were doing. They didn't like the compromise. But people liked it. The compromise was popular with Americans, and Millard Fillmore, the vice president who would become president upon the death of President Zachary Taylor. When Fillmore became president, he used the power of his office to persuade Northern Democrats, men like Stephen Douglas, and Whigs to come together and support the legislation. Things that would never get done in a Congress with Southern members who could block legislation. And the legislation was passed, the Compromise of 1850, not just one bill, but a series of bills, which each of which could get enough votes to pass. Many members voting differently on each bill, the Henry Clay way, methods that are still used today in Congress. And California was admitted as a free state, the farthest-reaching state in the West would be free, pointing a beacon as to how things might be in the future. But at the same time, the newly powerful fugitive slave law meant that the Fillmore administration would be enforcing slaves being brought back to masters, many who had been up in northern states for decades. Federal troops would come to Boston to deliver a runaway slave who had started a store there and had quite a following. He would be protected in a church and eventually would flee to Nova Scotia. Stories like that would happen all over the North. Both Webster and Clay would die just 2 years after the compromise, knowing what they did was right in order to save the Union. And although Webster lost a lot of friends, the compromise most likely put off war between North and South for 10 years. And for the North, the 10 years of expansion to the West and money being made, of manufacturing and improving, not to mention the California gold, assisted in the war effort to great degrees. A bitter pill was swallowed, perhaps for a good reason. As Speaker Newt Gingrich made his way over to the White House in December of 1997, he might have known how Daniel Webster felt. The leader of the conservative revolution in Congress turned over a Congress that had been held by Democrats for over 40 years, had been bested in a budget showdown by President Clinton, narrowly escaped a coup by his own conservative congressional members. He was supposedly coming over to the White House to resume the 1998 budgets, which presumably were going to go a lot better than the showdown over the 96 one. But that's not why Gingrich was really coming to the White House. He and the president were in collusion of sorts. They were to talk about a deal that was the moral equivalent, perhaps, in 1990s politics of the Compromise of 1850 for its time, a way of saving Social Security between the two parties. Clinton and Gingrich had phone calls and conversations had gone on between each of their closest aides. Erskine Bowles, the chief of staff under Clinton during his second term, helped to negotiate a meeting. Gingrich liked Bowles. Bowles was a moderate Democrat from North Carolina and a business person. Many aides also suspected that Gingrich and Clinton liked each other. Both were highly intellectual politicians. They liked to debate history and talk about policy, although their politics, of course, were very different. The nuances of the relationship between Clinton and Gingrich were such that key aides wanted to keep them away from each other. At the meeting, they agreed to a deal that went something like this. Gingrich would anger many Republicans by not using the newfound surplus. There was a surplus in the 1998 budget, if we remember, for a tax cut. He wouldn't use it for a tax cut, but instead would use it to shore up the Social Security Trust Fund, the type of policy that Clinton had advocated. Clinton would anger his own Democrats by supporting a partial private savings account and an increase in the age that one could collect Social Security at. Gingrich wasn't alone. He would work with Bill Archer, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, to get enough Republicans and get rid of an issue that had been used as a club by Democrats against Republicans for quite a long time. Clinton would also have a task. He would utilize his New Democrats and Blue Dog Democrats, conservative, moderate Democrats, to get votes. Gingrich made it very clear to Bowles, it was a coalition, not a partnership. After the deal was made, the president and Gingrich would go on battling each other. But on this issue, they would work together. Gingrich would endure the wrath of Tom DeLay, the majority leader of the House, and one who already found Gingrich to be too intellectual, soft, and not willing to take on the White House in every battle. Clinton would incur the wrath of Dick Gephardt, who felt that Clinton was not a true Democrat, who had already made a speech at the John F. Kennedy Center for Politics, sort of, without taking Clinton directly on, advocating that Democrats must act like real Democrats, an indication that at least Mr. Gephardt would be providing some intra-party opposition and perhaps running for president in 2000. Both knew that they could probably best these opponents in their own party, especially given the status of statesmanship that such a deal would give them. In the 1990s, Americans were sick of politics. Ross Perot had gained a lot of votes in both the 92 and 96 elections. Clinton had won re-election, but narrowly. Republicans had held on to the House in the same year. Americans weren't really ready to sign off on either party. There were no statesmen. Gingrich and Clinton both knew that with this kind of a deal, they could gain an aura that they didn't have before. Clinton was never comfortable in the liberal caucus, and Gingrich wanted to be seen as getting something done, not just the evil man in all those Democratic ads taking away people's Medicare. The meeting held in December 1997 is not a meeting that many Americans know about. It's not a story that's really been told. There is a recent book out called The Pact that details the story. But it only came out in 2006. That's because the act in the play that Americans should have seen was this. In the 1998 State of the Union, Clinton was to go out and advocate for using the surplus to save Social Security first. And he would say that it would be okay to establish some kind of private savings account. Then, after the president gave his State of the Union, it would be time for the Republican response. And that would be delivered by his supposed arch nemesis, Newt Gingrich. Usually the Republican response is used to criticize the president's speech. In this case, Gingrich would surprise everyone by agreeing with the president and pledging that he would do everything he could to work with him to save Social Security. It would have been quite an event in American politics and an act of bipartisanship we weren't treated to. Instead, Gingrich didn't deliver the response. Clinton didn't call for private savings account, though he did advocate using the surplus for saving Social Security. And that was because prior to those speeches, Americans would learn the name of Monica Lewinsky. Gingrich did the political calculations, as Clinton had as well. Neither of them could break from their party at this point. Clinton needed the liberals and Democrats to save his presidency. Couldn't disappoint them now. It's a little-known story, not only about bipartisanship in America, but about how truly devastating the Lewinsky matter was to the Clinton presidency. For two Democratic presidents seeking passage of civil rights bills, the greatest hope was a Republican senator. Both Lyndon Johnson, both President Kennedy while he was alive, and Lyndon Johnson, who took over after Kennedy's death, knew that with so many segregationist Southern Democratic senators, only the Republicans could break the filibuster that invariably would happen anytime the Senate considered civil rights bills. Civil rights bills in America had been introduced as early as the 1940s, allow every citizen to vote or to work, regardless of their race. Only the filibuster prevented it from happening for another 20 years, and it happened because of bipartisan cooperation. Everett Dirksen, the minority leader in the Senate from Illinois, held the Republican votes needed to break a filibuster on civil rights. But his Republicans were reluctant. Why should they move to help Democratic presidents? So when, after Kennedy's death, a House bill on civil rights passed, and Johnson asked Dirksen to help, he faced strong opposition, especially from his Republican rival for the leadership, a conservative who didn't want the legislation, Bork Hickenlooper of Indiana. He was the leader of a group of conservatives. Dirksen decided to take the moral high ground. He called a press conference and stated the moral reasons why a civil rights bill must pass and pass now. Called out, it would be hard for Republicans now to vote against what their leader had advocated in the press. After forging the right bill with the compromises that his members could agree with, Dirksen took the Senate floor and called for a cloture motion to shut down the filibuster. Victor Hugo once said, "Stronger than all the armies in the world is an idea whose time has come." Everett Dirksen and his Republican votes shut down the filibuster, and then in a simple vote, the Civil Rights Bill of 1964 passed. The Republican contribution to civil rights is a credit to their party, and one that any Republican now should feel proud about. But it's one that's eclipsed in history because in the very same year, just a month later, the party nominated Barry Goldwater, a person who was a conservative who was running against civil rights and getting the votes of the same Southerners who had filibustered. These are giant compromises and examples of bipartisan, or at least bifaction, cooperation. Certainly Clay and Webster were both Whigs, but the Whig Party was not a united party. It had many factions, Southern, Northern, border states. Clay was a border state Whig and Webster a Northern Whig. Americans tend to like these compromises, and major pieces of legislation in America have often passed through some series of compromises. Not exclusively so, however. One of the most famous examples of bipartisanship was when Abraham Lincoln chose Andrew Johnson, you know, member of the Democratic Party, but a war Democrat who had supported the Union effort in the Civil War. Lincoln realized that without those war Democrats, he would not have been able to fight the war. And so Andrew Johnson of Tennessee became his vice presidential nominee. And that was symbolic of other cooperation that Lincoln got, at least in the war effort, from war Democrats. Civil War is very much a bipartisan war. But is bipartisanship always good? Perhaps not. Here's one bad example. Both parties in Congress compromise on ethics to keep it off the table. The House of Representatives makes its own rules. The Senate makes its own rules. The House of Representatives has an ethics committee. Both Republicans and Democrats have had an unwritten rule to keep ethics questions off the table. No one challenges another member of Congress of whatever party. Only when a congressman, Chris Bell of Texas, was redistricted and then would no longer be in Congress, he put in a complaint about Tom DeLay, which led to Tom DeLay's indictment. Interestingly enough, Bell was chastised by many, even Democrats, for breaking the pledge on ethics. Some might argue that the House might be flooded with ethics complaints going back and forth if it were opened up, but in my mind, that's an example of bipartisanship gone bad. In 1974, bipartisan negotiations, which were directed by Nixon White House Chief of Staff Al Haig, almost stopped the impeachment and brought it to a special committee, which would have had members more favorable to the Nixon White House than the Judiciary Committee, which was led by partisan Democrats. Bipartisan efforts there might have allowed Nixon to stay in the White House. Finally, in 1861, before President Lincoln was able to take office in March, bipartisan efforts between elected Republicans and border state Whigs and Unionists might have led to a constitutional amendment against any prohibition on slavery in an attempt to avoid a war, whether it would have worked or not. Still, bipartisanship is a necessary part of America, and for several reasons. One is simple math. The members of the Constitutional Convention and everyone who's had a role in government since then created so many checks and balances, committees, veto overrides, filibusters, etc. But the only way to get the necessary numbers is through reaching across the aisle. The other reason is political. Often, the call of statesmanship is more than just that. Andrew Johnson's appeal to small-time farmers and middle class was dependent on him attacking the slave power. It wasn't just that he altruistically wanted the Union to hold together. Everett Dirksen's northern constituency in Illinois was pushing him to support civil rights, as were the constituencies of many northern Republicans. Newt Gingrich and Dick Armey wanted the club of Social Security taken off the table. It wasn't just about statesmanship. Still, in all of these situations, statesmanship was also a motivation, and we can't exclude that. It's a powerful pull in American politics that individuals want to be seen as statesmen outside their parties in different situations. President Obama has been searching for bipartisanship more than many Democrats would even want. Deluge of calls to Olympia Snow of Maine have been revealed in the press. And indeed, it produced a result that President Obama wanted, with Snow voting for the Democratic compromise bill on health care out of committee. Not agreeing, of course, to the House bill or other provisions. That was a more conservative bill. In the House of Representatives, Joseph Gow of Louisiana became the only Republican to vote yes on the Democratic health care legislation. Don Young of Alaska, a good friend of Gow's, came close to doing so, and made a point of walking with him, standing by him, as he voted yes on the Democrats' health bill, just in case Republican colleagues tried to talk him out of it on the way to the vote. Some Democrats were happy to see at least one Republican vote for the health care bill. Republicans angered at this one maverick Republican. But Gao's motives, like so many other examples of bipartisanship, not all altruistic. He represents the district previously held by William Jefferson, a congressman who had been indicted and thus lost his seat to a Republican. The health care bill is extremely popular in his constituency. In the case of Olympia Snow, she's more well-established, but still represents a state where the president won by a large margin. Bipartisanship does matter, and Americans will look at, certainly the media will look at, and certainly politicians will look at, how many Republican votes President Obama gets for his legislation. It was devastating to President Clinton for his first budget to not get a single Republican vote in the Senate, and for Al Gore, the vice president, to have to break the tie because Democratic votes were lost. In the vote on the stimulus bill, President Obama was able to get Olympia Snow and Arlen Specter, at the time a Republican, to vote for stimulus. And then Arlen Specter switched to the Democratic Party. A strict partisan vote is probably seen as something to Americans like a shutout. Getting one, even among a House of Representatives with 435 people, is better than zero. But still, Obama's bipartisan results pale in comparison to other presidents on other issues. President Bush's tax cut received many Democratic votes. Ronald Reagan's tax cut received 26 Democratic votes. Many Democrats voted both for the Iraq War resolution in 2002 and for George Bush Sr.'s Gulf War resolution of 1991. Obama's results are paltry compared to these issues, but it could be argued these were easier votes to take, taking on a villain in the Middle East, voting to cut people's taxes, always popular ideas. There are times in American politics for partisanship and times for bipartisanship, but usually the legislation passed by bipartisan means is stronger, longer lasting, though not what either side wants. As Americans view the Obama administration and the performance of the Democratic Congress, one thing they'll be looking at is bipartisanship. It's nothing new. I want to thank you for listening. Website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. We're on Facebook. The archive is available for $9.99. You get everything we've recorded just about since 2006, everything that I have a recording of, at least. And some extras. We have an examination of presidential rhetorical speaking styles, a talk about representation in America. Do we really have a very representative government? An analysis of the 2008 election and what happened, and many more things. Website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. Thanks for listening.